Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
When I worked in the White House, I had the honor of meeting Gordon Brown, who was then Prime Minister of Great Britain. He was then, as he is today, a brilliant and passionate thinker about public policy. That's reflected in his newest book, 7 Ways to Change the World: How to Fix the Most Pressing Problems We Face. I sat down with Mr. Brown for a live virtual chat this week at the Institute of Politics. Here's that conversation. Prime Minister Gordon Brown, it's so good to see you again, especially at such an interesting, challenging time for the world. I'm looking forward to getting some of your wisdom. So welcome to the Axe Files. Welcome to the University of Chicago Institute of Politics.
Well, we're missing your advice and wisdom that you brought to bear when you were in government. So
thank you.
It'll be good to talk about some of the issues that are got to be solved, got to be dealt with.
Before we do that, though, I want to talk about you and your journey. It started in Kirkcaldy. Did I say that right?
Kirkcaldy. It's Kirkcaldy, actually, and it's the birthplace of Adam Smith, and it's probably best known because he was such an important figure in economics. And next door is Dunfermline, which is the home of Andrew Carnegie. And of course, he remains well known for his philanthropic activities around the world. So
yes,
I was brought up in this, what is actually an industrial town, mining, coal mining and textiles on the periphery, if you like, of the conurbation of Edinburgh. And, you know, what I saw growing up, I'm afraid, was a lot of poverty, a lot of unemployment. And that's what really influenced me.
Presumably, your folks were an influence as well. Your father, Dr. John Ebenezer Brown, which is a wonderfully British name, was a minister in town. Tell me about him and the influence that he had on you.
Well clearly, religion, Christianity, growing up as the son of minister with two brothers in this town was bound to have an influence on you. And you're talking about the 1950s and the 1960s when, just like America, Scotland was probably the most religious country after America in the whole world, where everybody or large numbers of people went to church. So it can't not have an influence on you. And, you know, my father wasn't party political in the sense that he would try to influence his congregation with his views, but I always knew that he was a believer in social justice. There was a friend of him, actually, that every time that the Labour Party, you know, the equivalent of your Democrats, won, he would call the hymn on the Sunday, "Now thank we all our God." But if the party lost and the Conservatives or someone won, it was, "Dear Lord of Father of Mankind, forgive our foolish ways." And of course, if the Nationalists or some third party won, it was, "God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform." So it wasn't blatant religious propaganda coming from my father. He was always very conscious that in his congregation, there were people of so many different views. And I grew up aware that you had to respect all views in politics, although I felt the poverty that I saw around me, because this was a time of huge change. The mining industry was falling. Textile, I remember one company just a few yards from where we lived had a factory, and 500 people were made redundant in 1 week. And that really had an influence on me. I thought, you've got to be able to do something about this. My school friends were leaving to go to other parts of the country, and there was an emigration happening because of unemployment, and I felt we needed to do something about it. So that's my interest in economics, but also my interest in social justice.
You and your brother started a newspaper when you were a kid, and the proceeds of which went to, I guess, African refugees. Is that
It's called Freedom from Hunger. It was a campaign being run by Oxfam to try to alert people to the malnutrition that was taking place in Africa. So we raised money. My brother was actually more innovative than me. He got an interview with John Glenn, your famous astronaut. Harold Wilson, who was the prime minister, he got an interview with him. I did the sports commentary. But it was really interesting because you were raising money for a charity and finding out about what was happening in the rest of the world. And I think a lot of young people growing up at that time became more aware. As Britain, you know, Britain's empire was collapsing, we were leaving Africa, but there was huge problems of poverty and hunger, and partly because of civil wars, but also because of just the sheer poverty of the places. So I became very aware that there was an international context to the poverty we were seeing.
This was a through line in your life. I mean, one of your great achievements in public life was to persuade the U.S. and Europe to join Britain in debt relief for Africa, and you're still working on issues of disease and poverty in Africa today.
Yeah, and when I finally persuaded, Larry Summers was the Treasury Secretary at the time, and when we finally persuaded him, and that was the key person at that time to persuade, it was a great success. And I think we wrote off as a world about $200 billion of debt of some of the poorest countries in Africa and Asia. And that made it possible for them to spend. And I think we've got evidence of that, to spend on health and education where they were spending on debt interest payments. So the lessons I learned young were applied. And, you know, when you say to people debt relief, a banker will tell you, you know, moral hazard, moral hazard. And we started off with 80% debt relief, then 90%, then 95%. And suddenly it was 100% debt relief. And people say, you can't do that. That's just against the way the financial system works. But we wrote up about $200 billion of debt.
You were kind of a prodigy in school. You went to high school at 10. You went to the university at 16. I think you were the youngest student there since 1945 or something. How did that work for you?
I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. I was very young when I went to university. I mean, I'd done all the exams at 15 and I got there at 16. I actually ended up in hospital the first week I was at university, so I missed actually much of the first and second years because I'd got an injury playing playing football, and I lost the sight of my eye, and I had to be in hospital for months as a result of that. So I did get to university at 16. I probably started studying at 18.
Well, let me ask you about that. I know you mentioned you were the sports editor of your little newspaper while your brother was going off and getting the celebrity interview. But you were quite an athlete, and you got kicked in the head playing rugby to detach
almost as dangerous as American football, you know, but without the head shield. So, you know, there's no protection if you're playing rugby.
I thought you were saying almost as dangerous as American politics, but
both.
But you lost the sight in one eye, and you very nearly lost the sight in your other eye. That is a incredible.
You know, I thank Chicago for that. I thank Chicago because the surgeon who saved my eyesight, I walked into a hospital thinking I was about to go blind because what had happened in my first eye and I'd gone blind was happening in my second eye. And I was only 19, 20. And I believe that there was no way to save it because they had failed three times with one eye. And then a young guy who had been trained in Chicago had come back to Edinburgh. He was of Indian background, a great, magnificent medical doctor. And I was probably his first operation, and the surgeon handed it to him. And he used all the new techniques that had been developed in Chicago, and my eyesight was saved. And it was just remarkable because I really did feel I was about to lose all my sight.
How does a young guy process that? And how did it affect you during the rest of your life?
Well, I stopped playing rugby. Stopped playing football.
Seems sensible, yes.
You know, once something that you really love, like sport, you've got to be a spectator and not a participant. Once that goes, you really are thinking about what are you doing as a teenager? What are you doing in your early 20s? So I did think it made me realize that I had to do something different. And so I got more involved, obviously, in politics. I got more involved with the Labour Party in particular. And I've been very lucky because this retinal operation that I had has held for 50 years. So I've been very fortunate indeed. And I talk to this surgeon who's no longer young every few months, and he checks me out and everything else, and it's remarkable. But he was trained in Chicago, so you guys should be very pleased.
Yeah, we will take credit for that. Thank you. We'll remember that. You talked about the fact that your father was strategically nonpartisan in his approach, other than his choice of hymns at the end of elections. But when did you say, you know, I think this is what I want to do? Because you spent 10 years getting a PhD, teaching, you spent some time in television news. When was it that you decided? Yeah, I know you had a little campaign in there, and you were the rector of your university at a very young age. But yeah. What drew you to a career, to a life in politics?
Well, I think, as I said, once I was, you know, when you're recovering from an operation like a retinal detachment, you're lying blinded, in some cases for 3 weeks, and you can't see anything, and you have to think about the world. And I think that's the point at which I realized I wanted to be a university teacher, and I did do a lot of teaching, and I still do some. And I really enjoy doing lectures and tutoring. But I felt that the problems that I saw around us, we could do something about it. And I was particularly influenced by what I'd seen growing up. You know, we used to go and visit, my father and I used to visit families, because there was a lot of flooding happened in the town we grew up, because it was by the sea, and you saw the condition of the housing we were never very wealthy ourselves, but the point is, you saw people in a far worse position, and so you wanted to do something about it. And I think that's the influence, that public service can make a difference, that politics is not a game, it's about changing things. There's no point in going into politics if it's all that you want is to be famous. The only reason, and I still hold to that, is to see if you can make a difference. And politics is about hope. It's about giving people hope that things can actually change. And if you can show, it's more than optimism, which is things might change. I mean, hope means that you've got, and Barack Obama, of course, used the term audacity of hope. But hope means that you've got a determination that things will change. And I think that's what the best of politics is about.
Yeah, I've always said that politics divides into two categories: the people who run for office because they want to be something, and the people who run for office because they want to do something. And that second cohort, is a smaller and more admirable group of which you are one.
I mean, in Britain, they talk about this distinction between politicians who are bishops and politicians who are bookies, which is gamblers. And I suppose there is some truth in that. You've got a message you want to get across, or you're actually just playing a game. And I think the most successful politicians, and who you worked with, Barack Obama is one of them, I've got a message. They've got something they want to do, and they've got something they want to get completed.
Where do you think your current prime minister fits in?
The British prime minister? Well, I don't know if by the time people see this broadcast, whether you'll still be prime minister. I mean, we're going through prime ministers at a very fast rate. I mean, we've had David Cameron in 2016, Theresa May to 2019. Now Boris Johnson is hanging on at 2022. So there's a bit of a turnover here. And I mean, I think he comes on the gambling side, taking chances.
It seems so. Yeah, it looks like his luck may have run out here. But let's talk about your own journey to that office. You had run an unsuccessful race for Parliament, and then you ran another one and you won. And you came there as a Labour member at a most disadvantageous time, in that it was the height of the Margaret Thatcher era in Britain, and Labour was flat on its back. What were your thoughts when you arrived to this debacle?
Well, this was the nadir, because I'd stood in 1979 in Edinburgh, where I'd been a student, and I didn't win, obviously, and Labour did badly. And I stood in my home area in 1983 and won, and Labour did even worse. And people said of that campaign, it started badly and it fell away, because it was so bad. And people talked about our manifesto being the longest suicide note in history. And what had actually happened was that our policies had become different and did not reflect anymore our values. So we had all these policies about nationalization of this, about getting rid of our defense forces and everything else. And it no longer reflected the reason that people were, Labour were, if you like, on the left in politics in the first place. They didn't prove to be the best way of advancing social justice or liberty or freedom or even full employment. So we had to rethink completely. So I came in 1983, and Labour had a new leader, Neil Kinnock, which I helped elect him. Tony Blair and I were both, we actually shared an office in, for many years. And we realized that if the Labour Party didn't change, if it didn't modernize, then the Labour Party was never going to be able to survive. So we made it our business. I came from this very industrial seat in Scotland, so I was very aware that while people were loyal to Labour, they were not happy with Labour. And of course, in England, which was of course more traditionally conservative than Labour, people had walked away in droves. So we had to rebuild and realise that unless we could have policies that reflected our values, and this is the challenge for every party in politics, because the changing environment always requires you to rethink your policies. You've got to reappraise them every generation. But unless they reflected our values, we couldn't persuade people to stay with Labour. So we had this huge process, very difficult, very controversial. You know, some of our Labour people, when we came to America to talk to some of your people, they thought that was selling out. It was, you know, as if we were the Democrats, they're so right-wing. And that's what they said. And they said, no, we've got to listen to all the parties that are trying to do progressive change.
Well, Democrats during that era went through their own transition after a couple of disastrous elections. What lessons do you draw from that experience to today? Because Labour is trying to rebuild from some very tough losses. And you see Progressive Party, I mean, Democratic Party has its own challenges here, even though it is the party in power. What are the lessons that you carry from that experience to what you see today? And what advice would you give progressive parties?
Well, David, at an intellectual level, and you've been through this with the campaigns that you've run, you've got to reconcile your policies for economic progress with your policies for social justice. You can't have economic progress at the expense of social justice, but you're not going to get social justice unless you have policies for economic efficiency and economic progress. And that was really the challenge of the 80s and the 90s, and that led to Bill Clinton's policies at the end of the the 1980s and him winning the presidency of America. Now, I think we've got an even more challenging environment because almost every political party of the left has been posing the policies that they pose in terms of the nation state. And we've almost been oblivious to the fact that we've got a global economy. It's an open global economy. It's got to be managed better. And so most of the democratic social democratic parties or progressive parties you'll see in Europe are finding it really difficult to come to terms with the fact that all the levers they said that they would be able to pull previously, you just cannot pull. You're dealing with an international environment. You've got to have coordinated policies with other countries if you're going to make things happen. And we've seen that during the pandemic. We know exactly that's the problem on climate change, that one country can't solve that problem alone. And I think social democratic parties have found it very difficult to face up to this. And I think progressive parties across the world have got to have policies for this new era, which is global. And you've got to manage globalization. It's no use saying, you know, it's here and so just accept it. You've got to manage it. Otherwise, you get all the results that we've now got, which is massive inequality, of course. We've got protectionism now arising because people don't see that globalization's work. The 2008 financial crisis was a real problem because people could see the system wasn't working. They weren't getting the benefits themselves. And people then were persuaded by people like Trump that the answer was to retreat into the nation state. But of course, it's never going to be the answer in a world where you're going to need greater cooperation if you're going to solve some of these problems. You know, we had to deal with the breakdown of the banking system. And that was not just the American banking system. That was the global banking system. And it could only be solved by finding a way that we could collaborate globally to get the system back up and running. And I think possibly we saw that more clearly from Europe than was seen in America, where I think you saw it as an American problem more than as a global problem. But now I think we've got to realize that all these problems we face, the pandemic's obvious, climate change's obvious, financial instability's obvious, global inequality, these are problems that need a level of cooperation that is not against the national interest. It's a level of cooperation that is the only way that you can express the national interest and deliver on it.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You know, it's so interesting that the example you read, I remember, and we, I think, first met back in the era of the financial crisis when President Obama came to office, and the two of you worked closely in leading the world to solutions to that, to prevent a second Great Depression. But there was a terrible backlash in that period, because there was a feeling that the bankers had led the world over the cliff and that people were suffering. They were escaping with their bonuses, with their benefits, while others were struggling. And in a way, this triumph of global cooperation also had as part of it a backlash that has really helped fuel populism. Is there anything that
David, we didn't go far enough. Perhaps we didn't
have that's what I want to ask.
Sufficiently intensive cooperation. You see, I wanted a financial transactions levy because I didn't see why the public should pay the costs of financial crises that were caused by the people who were making a huge amount of money in the financial system. Now, I could not persuade America to do this. Actually, we persuaded France and Germany, and it's still the policy of the European Union to have such a levy. So in a strange sort of way, while the banks were really in trouble, and we nationalized to three of the banks in Britain, possibly doing more than you did.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we didn't create the mechanisms by which the public could see that the financial system was not going to get out of control in future, and the old practices were not going to come back. And one of the things we wanted was this financial transaction tax. And I'm afraid we didn't get it. And then I think one of the reasons why President Biden has done a very strong and fiscally active intervention to get out of this particular crisis is that there was probably not enough fiscal intervention in 2009 and 10. And when we left office, the mood in Europe changed almost entirely to being, you know, cutting down the deficits and cutting down the debt, an era of austerity. And that meant that Europe barely grew over the last 10 years. Yeah, I mean, the growth rate of Europe and Britain has been very low, and that's because they didn't have the fiscal push that was necessary and relied entirely on monetary policy. And I think you did better in the States, but I think we all could have done better. And we would have shown, I think, if we'd done these things in the next 2 or 3 years, that world economic cooperation worked, that you could manage globalization and we could manage trade to prevent protectionism. But instead, what you've seen is gradually you've got the trade barriers going up, you've got the immigration controls, which is another form of protectionism, of course, which is necessary and it's got to be managed, but also it's a reflection of people's demand for protectionism. And then you went to Donald Trump's America First, and you've got China First, you've got India First, you've got
Brexit.
Russia First, and to some extent Brexit shows an attempt to put Britain first. And for some of these countries, it's first and only. And so the nation is seen as the sole source of any economic initiative, and international cooperation is relegated, even although it's obvious when you've got pollution, it can't be solved by one country. It's obvious when you've got a pandemic, you've got to work together. And yet that lesson has not really been sufficiently realized in what people are doing in the last year.
Yeah, and this is an important point. It's not just a moral obligation to see to it, for example, that people around the world are vaccinated. It's very much about self-interest, as we see these new variants popping up in Africa and other places where there's a high degree of unvaccinated people, and that's where these variants breed.
You see, David, as you know, a politician will never get elected if he's not or she is not a patriot, if they're not seen to be standing up for the national interest, and that's absolutely right. And I, feel strongly. I'm Scottish and British. I mean, we're very patriotic. But you've got to show that your patriotism can be reflected in international cooperation. And it's not, there's not a choice between being patriotic and cooperating with other countries. It's a reflection of your patriotism that you can find a way to work with other countries in your own national interest. And we seem to have failed to get that message across. And certainly under President Trump, America sent out a completely different image of itself to the rest of the world. You know, then that encourages the reaction to globalization. You know, if you are now retreating into a national silo, then you don't really think that global economic activity and global cooperation can actually work. You know, I was at an IMF meeting when I was chairing it as a finance minister, and there was a big demonstration outside, and there was a banner that said "Worldwide Campaign Against Globalization." and you know what people meant, because they were fed up. Yes. And the politicians weren't always serious. I remember, I just say this because I think it sums up some of the problems in politics about taking these international issues seriously. When the financial crisis broke in 2009, we had a meeting with Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, the head of the European Union, the central bank, Berlusconi, the prime minister of Italy. And it was the weekend that really that Lehman Brothers had collapsed. People did not know quite what to do. America, I think Ben Bernanke said later, 18 banks might have gone under. And we met for an hour. We were talking about all the problems and how we could solve them. And, you know, I had this idea that we had to, we really had to invest in the banks, if necessary, to nationalize them so that they had enough capital. They had to be recapitalized. Anyway, we broke for coffee. And suddenly we had Berlusconi saying in his pidgin French, he said, "Amateurs," he said, "amateurs," he said, "c'est sont amateurs, they're all amateurs." And we think, we are all the amateurs. Berlusconi, the businessman, he's got the answer. And he said, "Don't they realize we've got a press conference in an hour and there's no makeup artist for any of them?" and that was the seriousness with which the biggest financial crisis we'd seen in our lifetimes.
But where I was going was, I mean, what you hear from voters, from the public, what you heard then and what reverberates even now is just that somehow the bankers got away with it. And there were bankers who were responsible for this, who never paid a price, that they never, you know, and I know this is more a Old Testament concept than a New Testament concept, but they wanted people to pay for their misdeeds. And they wanted to see people tried and prosecuted for it.
And David, if I'm honest, I think a lot of the problems have moved from the banking system to the shadow banking system. So mm-hmm. while we were tough on some of the regulation that we imposed on the formal banking system, we were not tough on the shadow banking system, which are lots of different organizations that operate as if they are banks, but are not subject to banking regulation. And we've seen a lot of scandals emerge over the last year or two. And I think we will have to look at the rules governing the shadow banking system as well in future. But clearly, the public did not see that they were benefiting from global change. And because China was, in a sense, becoming the manufacturing capital of the world, where it used to be America and Europe, and because they were paying a lot lower wages, then, of course, the pressure on manufacturing workers, factory workers, and then on all workers who were relatively low-skilled has become intense. And you can see that is one of the reasons why populist movements have grown up in America, but also right across Europe. And I think people sometimes forget that although there's very few governments other than the Hungarian government, for example, that are nationalist, or the Polish government, very nationalist and anti-immigrant and everything else, that nationalist movements are having some effect in almost every part of Europe. The Scandinavian politics have changed. Belgium is always in danger of breaking up. Catalonia and Spain, Scotland and the United Kingdom. And these nationalist movements, Le Pen in France, they become strong. And, you know, Steve Bannon from the States has been going around Europe trying to, you know, if you like, to get an international coalition of anti-internationalists, if you like. But that's what he's been trying to do.
No, he fashions himself a historic figure in that regard. Yeah, and, in America, by the way, are happy to lend him to you for as long as you'd like to have him.
It's the one immigrant I would not like to come to Europe. No, it's one of... But it is a problem where you have these populist. So you've got protectionism now, trade protection, obvious. You've got great big power competition rising, China and America, Russia and America, Russia and the West, of course, with what's happening in Ukraine. And you've got these populist nationalist movements. There's about 50 secessionist movements in different parts of the world now, wanting to break up the existing order of nation states. And I think people are very slow to wake up to the fact that nationalism is now the dominant ideology of our age. You know, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, I'd have said maybe neoliberalism, it was an economic ideology, Washington Consensus, whatever you called it. I think nationalism is now the biggest political force of our times. And even President Biden, you know, I think he left Afghanistan, didn't really consult the 40 allies that America had in Afghanistan. And some of the policies that I think people are pursuing are too protectionist and too nationalistic and too chauvinistic. And I think we've got to fight it.
Do you think that it was a mistake for him to leave Afghanistan?
Not to leave, but I think the way it was done, I think he himself would be honest enough to admit that this was not done well. And we're dealing with really huge humanitarian problems in Afghanistan that we will pay a price for later if we don't do something about. You know, there are 23 million people who are said to be without food in Afghanistan, and even the international appeals to get money on humanitarian grounds that would go through UNICEF and NGOs rather than through the Afghan government. These are not being responded to in the way that they should. We went into Afghanistan and we said we were there to help the people of Afghanistan, and you can't just abandon them completely and leave them to effectively starve, which is what's going to happen this winter if we don't take action.
You've said that you thought it may be the biggest humanitarian crisis we've seen in many, many years.
In numbers, yes, because 5 million children face death. And, you know, any one child who's in danger and difficulty, there's not a parent in America that wouldn't feel that something had to be done to help a child in such distress, emaciated, you know, no hospital care because health centers have been closed. We really have a responsibility to do something about it, not to give legitimacy to the Taliban, but to actually get humanitarian aid in. We did this with Zimbabwe when we were fighting the regime, but at the same time, we didn't want people to starve. And I think it's possible to do this with Afghanistan.
You mentioned Scotland, where you live, and you have a deep interest and commitment to Scotland. There was a referendum, and you played a role as a former prime minister in this for independence in 2016. You were was it 2016? I don't know.
2014,
yeah. And that was narrowly defeated, 55-45. Polling now suggests a much closer division in Scotland over this. And some would say, looking at these numbers, that if there were such a vote today, that it might be for independence, in keeping with your notion of nationalism as a growing force. What are the prospects of keeping Britain together, and what happens if there's another vote in Scotland as the Scottish National Party would like?
Yeah, at the moment it looks as if you might not win this, and certainly the government of the United Kingdom is very, very unpopular, and the Prime Minister is very unpopular in Scotland. But you've got to win this as an argument, and the argument is not really being put at the moment. I mean, nationalism arises where you've got allegations of cultural discrimination or economic exploitation or political exclusion. And I think the nationalists want to persuade the Scots that they're in that position. I think we've got to show that cooperation, solidarity, empathy, sharing, these are very important principles in modern politics, and you can't have two nations sitting side by side with each other without some form of cooperation that works. And unfortunately, the Nationalist Party want to take Scotland out of every British institution. It's not a federal state they're proposing. It's not some form of autonomy within a United Kingdom. They want a complete break with England. And of course, so much of our economy is integrated, but also, you know, half Scots have relatives in England. So you've got to persuade people that in the modern world, cooperation, solidarity, empathy are necessary if you're going to run a modern society and economy. So that's what the issue is. It's easy to say, you know, Scots are a minority. Look, I was Prime Minister. I was a Scot, proud to be a Scot. 5 million Scots, but 65 million population of Britain. It's very unusual for someone from a small country in the United Kingdom to be the Prime Minister. And I can understand that people in England, you know, are the majority, but you've got to find a way that people can actually find to work together. And that's what's missing at the moment, that neither is the government of the United Kingdom proposing how we could cooperate better in the future, nor are the nationalists prepared to abandon a policy which is for complete separation, which means that even on policies like the environment, you wouldn't have the degree of cooperation that's necessary. You know, the vaccination in Britain has been a UK-wide vaccination. It's not been a Scottish or English or Welsh effort. It's been a whole UK effort administered in the different countries. And that's the sort of lesson that I learned, that if you're dealing with a major crisis, you've got to find a basis on which you can actually cooperate. And that's really the argument that's going to have to be fought out.
I don't want to let you off the hook here, because I know you'd rather talk about these policies, and we should, but I do want to follow the thread of your own progress and get back to that office that you shared with Tony Blair and the things that you did together, because you were very much aligned, and then you became a force within the Labour Party. He was a force within the Labour Party. You became almost a co-prime minister when you were Chancellor of the Exchequer. You handled all of the economic policy, all of the domestic policy. And there was tension between the two of you. It is a hard thing. I remember when Ronald Reagan was talking about adding Gerald Ford to his ticket as vice president, and it was described as a co-presidency, and nobody could figure out how that would work. And it didn't, it felt like, as just as a matter of personal relationships, it didn't work all that well. It worked effectively in terms of public policy, not so much with your personal relationships back in that period.
I'll see Tony probably next week when I'm in London. But look, we worked together for 25 years, but obviously you come to your political views from different perspectives. I mean, you know, I came from a highly industrialized mining community that was, you know, very concerned about issues of social justice. And I was always trying to reconcile that with the needs of economic efficiency and economic progress. Perhaps Tony came from a different perspective. And obviously, we had disagreements. I mean, I didn't want, for example, tuition fees to be charged. I wanted a graduate tax. I didn't want to commercialize or privatize, whatever you call it, parts of the National Health Service. I thought we could work within that service while using private contractors where necessary. But so there were disagreements on policy issues. But look, if you work together with someone for 25 years and you're still working together until the day Tony left as prime minister, then, you know, I think that shows that we had so much in common. That we, you know, we introduced a national minimum wage in Britain. We doubled the expenditure on health and education, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. We introduced nursery education, and you know, we introduced civil rights for gay people and everything else. So we did a whole series of changes together, and Tony deserves credit for many of them that were his personal initiative, and perhaps I deserve some credit for some of them that were mine.
Well, no question about that, including fiscal discipline and restraint and doing these progressive things within the context of policies that people saw as fiscally responsible.
Our slogan at one point was prudence for a purpose, that we had to get the debt in Britain down. Britain was really, you know, if you think of Britain in the, they used to say about Britain of the 1950s that we were managing decline. And then they said in the 60s, we were mission managing decline. And then they said in the 70s, we were declining to manage. And Britain had a huge inflation problem. And it was every time there was growth, there was massive inflation. And you had to raise interest rates and the economy was then in recession. And so we wanted to create a more stable economic environment as the platform for investing in our public services and relieving people from poverty. And that's what we tried to do. So it was prudence for a purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, we fought the election in 2001 on hospitals and schools first. That we wanted to create the economic environment in which social progress was possible. Now, obviously, the financial crisis was a real problem for us. But even throughout the financial crisis, we managed to maintain the expenditures on people in need, and we kept unemployment far lower than it was in America. I mean, I don't think unemployment went beyond about 7% in Britain, whereas it went beyond 10% in Europe and America. So we always had in mind that the purpose of our politics was to deliver a more just society. And to be honest, we did not do enough, and no government has done enough about inequality. And we are still waiting for the sort of action that is necessary, I think, to deal with some of the worst excesses of inequality in our communities.
I will just say parenthetically that one aide of one or you, yours or Blair's, was quoted as saying that they felt like the children of a dysfunctional relationship. So,
but you know, Bono used to call us John and Paul. You know, like John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Look, we worked together for 25 years. But you know, in politics, that everybody comes with their own views and their own background and their own ideas that they want to implement. I probably wanted to do more on the social policy side, but you know, we had to work it out, and we did for 25 years.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. So let me ask you a question about one decision that was made, and this wasn't on the in your portfolio, but the decision to follow President Bush's lead in Iraq. It was a deeply unpopular decision, ultimately, in Britain. As you look back at that, how important was that decision in terms of how people viewed Blair and Labour in the later years of your partnership?
Well, I think we lost the 2010 election for a number of reasons, because of the austerity and the crash. But I think Iraq was very important. We'd been losing votes in 2005 and 2010. So I think public opinion did turn against the decision. I was given...
How do you look back at that decision?
Well, it was a mistake. I'm in no doubt that you cannot justify the intervention in Iraq as a just war on all the moral criteria that are put forward, because we could have done more to avoid it. And there were other options available, I think. The problem was the information that we had was flawed. And there's no doubt about it that I was given information, and people told me they knew exactly where these weapons that Saddam Hussein had were. They could pinpoint the street, if you like, or the place, or the area. And I was given all that information, and it proved to be wrong. And I think America was basing its information on exiles from Iraq who were giving a false picture. Now, the question is, who knew what? I certainly did not know that he had none of the weapons that were alleged. And I had to go on the information that I had at that time. Subsequently, I've seen documents that show that some people knew, but I certainly didn't know. But when you look at that intervention and you look at what constitutes a just war, I think you've got to be honest that there were other options available.
Do you feel you were intentionally misled?
I don't know who knew. You know, there are documents that have come out of the State Department of America showing that some officials doubted whether they were giving the information about weapons, and doubted whether that information that was being passed to them was accurate. But I never saw a British document saying, you know, this is all inaccurate, this is not true, this is cannot be true. But I think we learn lessons from this, that you really have got to base your decisions on accurate information, and you've got to test it to the limits. The problem is, as you know, some people wanted the war anyway, irrespective of whether he had weapons of mass destruction or weapons that were lethal in the way that was alleged. And some of us were prepared to listen to the evidence, and of course wanted to work through the United Nations, which was always the aim of the policy, but at least from Britain's point of view, but it never quite worked out. So you learn lessons all the time. And one of the lessons that you learn from both Afghanistan and Iraq, and of course the Afghanistan intervention was justified and can be justified as an essential means of defeating terrorism, but you learn how difficult it is to state build or to go into a country and suggest that you can somehow rebuild a society from outside. You've got to be far more humble about what your ability to do that is. And I think that's what we've learned in Afghanistan, that nation building or state building, because it was really only state building, didn't actually work, and that the country was not ready, partly because of its economic conditions, partly because of its medieval systems of government, partly because of the tribal loyalties. And that form of state building, or which was called nation building, has got to be, you've got to be very modest and humble about what can be achieved. But that doesn't relieve you of a responsibility for humanitarian support.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Afghanistan would have been different in any way had there not been the distraction of Iraq?
I think Afghanistan was subject to a whole series of different mission statements, so to speak. You know, we went in to defeat the Taliban. The Taliban were defeated and moved out of office, but we stayed in Afghanistan. And then a number of objectives were set forward. We could make it a more democratic society. We could get rid of the heroin trade. We could build local government. We could create a central government that was effective. We could build schools. We could build hospitals. And I think we went absolutely clear, and I'm talking about the whole coalition of 40 countries, that having defeated the Taliban, what actually was it possible to achieve? And of course, in the end, you've got to recognize that that the support that we had expected from local people ended up not being there as the Taliban moved in the last year.
There's a major crisis in the world today relative to Ukraine and Russia's intentions toward Ukraine that has brought implications for NATO, for Europe. How do you assess the threat, and what should NATO be doing now?
I think, David, you've got to come back to where we are as a world community now. I mean, we had a unipolar age. America was completely dominant. And America generally, not with Iraq, of course, but generally acted multilaterally in a unipolar age. Now, the problem has been under President Trump, and there is still a legacy. America is still acting unilaterally in a multipolar age. So America no longer wants to be the world's policeman, but it's got to be the world's leading problem solver. So America's got to be the leader of multilateral action. Now, I think that's been missing in the analysis of where American foreign policy should move over future years. And, you know, over Afghanistan, as I said, there was very little contact with the members of the 40 members of the coalition when you left Afghanistan. Now on Ukraine, perhaps belatedly, there's a great deal more cooperation. And so the issue is, how can you make the strength that comes from the cooperation you can build internationally, with America obviously the leader, and as I say, the problem solver, how can you actually make that work? Now, Putin's at his time of greatest power, because he's got the oil price rising, he's got an energy shortage, he's got big reserves, he's far more self-sufficient than he was a few years ago. And my meetings with Putin have always convinced me that you've got to show strength. You cannot show any weakness. He's an opportunist. You know he wants to control Ukraine, but he's an opportunist and will only do what he thinks he can get away with. And you've got to show strength. You know, we had Litvinenko was a Russian who was killed on the streets of London, as you know, assassination. I knew that Putin was behind this. I knew also he was planning further assassinations. So we had to show strength. And the only way I think we stopped there being further assassinations, the guard dropped actually a few years later, was making sure that both we protected those people who were in difficulty, but equally at the same time, the message went out that we were going to take the toughest possible action. And you know that strength is what has got to be shown here. And that's why I think pulling together the coalition that America is now doing is really important. And I think the economic sanctions which are being proposed have got to be very tough. And you've got to bring Europe together, because there are obviously the people who are going to suffer most from the imposition of sanctions are not America. It's going to be European countries. And they've got to be brought on board so that they are aware that while there may be some suffering, they've got support from all their allies. We've got to find oil and gas from other parts of the world if necessary, but we can't allow ourselves to be completely at the mercy of Russian energy in Central and Western Europe.
You know, I listened to you talk about what's needed in the world, and it makes me think about where we've traveled from the World War II, when in reaction to the disorder of the world, we created all of these global institutions, America being at the center of many of them, and now we see a retreat, we see a weakening of these global institutions. We saw under Trump a retreat from NATO. Are we going through a transition here? Can these institutions be reinvigorated? I feel listening to you talk like you are holding a candle up here in a gale force wind.
I think we can rebuild the institutions. Look, I was just looking the other day at the end of the Bretton Woods Conference in America, New Hampshire, where you decided with American leadership to create the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and a new system of economic cooperation. And the American Treasury Secretary at the time, and I just took this out because I thought we might be discussing this, we have come to recognize that the wisest and most effective way to protect our national interests is through international cooperation. Now, how many people believe that today? And that's why I say nationalism has become the dominant ideology of the age, that people feel that the, if you like, a narrow definition of the pursuit of national interests, even at the expense of international cooperation, is the best way to present yourself to the world. And so the World Trade Organization has become ineffective. Cooperation on getting the vaccination to the rest of the world, I mean, this is a moral failure of huge proportions. I mean, you know, America and Britain, 70% vaccinated, Africa, 7%, you know, and we've got the vaccines. We're producing 1.2 billion a month. We could get them to Africa, but there's not been the money and there's not been the pressure sufficiently strong so that we actually suffer because the virus comes back in a new form.
Yes, this is where Omicron was born.
And it's the same thing with Afghanistan. Terrorism will come back because all these groups will be saying to people in Afghanistan, now, look, we told you, these people, coexistence is impossible. They're never going to help you now. They were only doing it for themselves. They're not interested in you as a person or your lives or your hunger. And then, of course, you get mass migration, which is going to be a huge issue. You're going to see far more migration from Africa to Europe than from any country to America, you know. And so Africa, with its doubling of population, is going to become a huge source of migratory pressures. And again, from Afghanistan, people are migrating. They become an issue in the rest of Europe. And so enlightened self-interest would make you cooperate. Now, there's the moral issue about solidarity with people who are in need and a duty of care and compassion. But there's the enlightened self-interest that comes from avoiding terrorism, about dealing with migration, about preventing, for example, from Afghanistan, the heroin trade coming back into all the streets of our cities. And so I would like to make the argument that, you know, in the 1940s, we managed to cooperate in even more difficult circumstances and form new institutions. But look what's happened now. We could act on smallpox in the 1960s with an international levy that we agreed to do together, but we couldn't agree on sharing the burden for dealing with COVID. On climate change, we only got so far at Glasgow, but this issue that nationally determined contributions is, you know, every nation is free to set its own limits and extent of what it does. And there's no sense that we're all coming together to create one point of pressure to get the carbon numbers down. And so when you look at all these areas, and then I look at nuclear proliferation, this is something that I think America has really got to take on board, because it looks to me as if Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon if we can't to get an agreement very soon. But then I do say Saudi Arabia.
Saudis will follow, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then you'll have UAE, then you'll have Turkey, then you'll have Egypt, and then you might even go into Africa and Nigeria. All these countries will think that the only way that they can be a power in the world is by having their own nuclear weapon. And so the deal that President Obama done may not have been perfect, but we're not able to rebuild it because Iran is so near to getting a nuclear weapon. Now, that's where nuclear non-proliferation talks are necessary. And that's where I think President Biden's got the right ideas. And during his election campaign, he put forward these ideas about, you know, banning your testing, enriching of uranium, banning that, no first use, no sole use if necessary. And I think he could have built and is in a position to build global support for that. But at the moment, it looks as if Iran is going to start off a new wave of proliferation. And whereas President Kennedy stopped the proliferation in the 1960s, we are starting to look as if we're going to have a new wave, maybe another five countries becoming nuclear weapons powers if we don't get the level of international cooperation that I'm talking about.
Just very briefly, because I do want to finish on a couple of personal notes, which may give you an incentive not to be brief, I don't know. But China, I know you've been concerned about the sort of bellicose rhetoric going back and forth between the U.S. and others in China. What is the proper approach to China, given the sort of muscularity of Xi and his...
I think the approach is the one that was set out by Jake Sullivan and by the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, and by Joe Biden himself, and that is cooperation where possible, but confrontation where it becomes necessary. And I do think that we should be trying to find areas of cooperation. Otherwise, we will definitely move to something like one world, two systems if we don't actually find a basis on which we can work together on certain key issues. We tried on climate change, not entirely successful because President Xi didn't turn up at the conference. I think we should try on obviously weaponry is absolutely critical, particularly when artificial intelligence is now being used and it's very unpredictable what might happen unless fail-safe mechanisms. And I think obviously we should have been doing more despite all the difficulties on global health, where we clearly have an interest. And the rising powers like China and India, they're going to have to pay some of the shares of these global public goods. When this is not a free lunch for these countries. But I think we are in the direction of one world, two systems. And that means a separate trade organization, a separate...
Which it runs completely counter to your prescription for what's needed.
Absolutely.
So here's what I wanted to ask you about two things that happened in your life. One I read about, which was the night before your father died, he called you, and you were I guess chancellor at the time, and you were deeply enmeshed in some issue, and you didn't have time to chat. And
I cut short the call because I was so busy thinking about something I had to do the next day, and the next morning he just collapsed and died, and it's something I will always regret.
And what did it tell you about you're a very driven person, obviously. Did it cause you to say, you know what, I've got to reorder things a little here. I got to think differently.
Yeah, and that when my daughter died, that also made me think that you know, family is really important. These things really touch you, and you feel that the time you give to your children is really, really important. And the time you give to some good causes to try and help people in difficulty, as you and your wife are doing, is very important too. So I think it does bring home to you that there is something more to life than work, but it also drives you on to do some of the things that you think are important that you my father or you know my family you know really believes in.
You mentioned your daughter Jennifer. She lived just 11 days, and you and your wife Sarah have committed yourself to the issue of infant mortality, prenatal care, and so on. Tell me about that.
I think it's fascinating the advances that are now being made because people are now putting money into research that might otherwise not be done. So, I mean, infant mortality is still very high, of course, in some of the poorest countries, but it's unnaturally, I think, high in some of the advanced countries as well.
Including the US.
Yeah, and we've realized we can do a lot of things. I mean, I was talking about blindness the other day, and we know that the levels of oxygen that a premature baby get affects whether that child is blind or not. So you're not born blind. It's the level of oxygen if you are a premature baby that you have to get. And if it's too big, it's too high, and if it's too low, it affects your ability to see. And that's one of the things that I think is changing. But also, I think we found that you can operate as surgeons within the womb to avoid certain conditions becoming obvious when a child is born or making it difficult for that child to survive. So there's a huge number of medical advances, just as in the area where you and your wife are working epilepsy, and equally in areas where we now are looking at, as a result of the virus, conditions like long COVID. I mean, we are going to see, as we've seen with vaccinations, massive, massive medical expertise being brought to bear. And we really have to support it as a global public good, as well as just what's happening in any individual hospital or in any individual country. The scope for people to live longer and live better is being enhanced every year by the medical advances. But perhaps we're not funding medicine and healthcare sufficiently for everybody to have the chance to benefit. So that's one of the things that really, I've been working with the World Health Organization over the last few months, because they need, as does Gavi, the Vaccination Fund, the Global Health Fund. They're all short of money. They're all running out of money. And people have got to realize that if you want these global public goods, and control of infection is one of the biggest global public goods, you've got to invest in it. And we're not doing enough to do so.
Well, let me say as we go that though your daughter didn't live long, the advances that have been made because of your advocacy and your wife's advocacy will have saved lives and have saved lives, I'm sure. And that's a tremendous legacy for Jennifer.
I hope. But, one of the inspirations for us is actually the work that you and your wife have done on epilepsy. And I don't want
Thank you.
Just to exchange congratulations, because that's not what we're about. But I think, your effort to deal with investment in cures, but also treatments for a disease that probably has been underinvested in is something that I really do admire. And it's not just had an effect in America, it's had an effect right across the world. So
thank you. Well, it is a way of, as you know, it is a way of transforming grief and anger into action that might help people. And I applaud my wife, Susan, for the great work she's done. Happy to help her, and so happy to be with you, Prime Minister. It's great to see you always. And thank you for your continued voice in the world. You are perhaps more than a candle. You're incandescent. And it's important, the spotlight you're shining on all of these issues. So thank you for that. And thank you for being with me today.
Well, working with you and some great Americans has been one of the joys of my life. And we continue, I hope, to have a very strong relationship across the Atlantic to be able to deal with these common challenges. So it's a pleasure both to have worked with you in the past when you were in government, but also to do this interview today. Thank you.
Hear, hear. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.